Governor Kim Reynolds is preparing to give her second condition of the state address. This is her first after being elected to the office for a full four-year term. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Public Radio. This hour, we'll bring you live coverage of the governor's speech. Thanks to Iowa Public Television for making this broadcast possible. Following the speech, join us for analysis with Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. We also want to hear your reactions to the speech as well. You can join us at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This address is an opportunity for the governor to speak to the state as a whole. It's a chance for her to lay out her priorities at the beginning of the legislative session. And now that she's been elected to office, this is an opportunity for her to shape the administration that is now her own. This morning, the Des Moines Register previewed a little bit of what we're expecting in the speech today, what we're expecting to be a very important part of the speech today. According to the Register, she's planning to propose a constitutional amendment lifting the felon voting ban in our state. She'll also call for several other changes to Iowa's criminal justice system in today's address. And right now, she is entering the chamber and approaching the podium again to give the condition of the state address, her first address after being elected to the office of governor for a four-year term. We'll go now to audio from Iowa Public Television.
It is my pleasure to introduce Governor Kim Reynolds for her condition of the state message for the 2019 session of the General Assembly.
Are we good? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, Mr. President, Madam Speaker, legislative leaders, senators, representatives, justices, judges, elected officials, distinguished guests, family, friends, and my fellow Iowans. The job of government, above all else, is to provide for the health and safety of its citizens. So I want to begin today by thanking the people who are on the front lines of providing that protection. Our men and women who serve in the military, law enforcement, and as first responders who risk their lives for us, and some pay the ultimate sacrifice. It was with great sadness last week we laid to rest Clinton firefighter Lieutenant Hossett, and it's with prayerful hope we watch firefighter Kane recover from the same tragic event. For these men and women, service isn't just part of their job, it's who they are, whether their uniform is on or off. Take Billy Fox. After graduating from Central College, he enlisted in the Army and joined the Special Forces. After almost 8 years of active service and tours in the Middle East, Billy returned to civilian life. He began his job search through home base Iowa and eventually landed at Vermeer back home in Pella. He started on the production line and quickly became the head of security, where his instincts to serve and protect would be put to use in ways that no one could imagine. On July 19th, a tornado ripped through Vermeer's campus, completely destroying one factory and heavily damaging others. It was devastating, and I saw it firsthand the next day. Metal was everywhere. Cars were piled on top of each other, and brick walls had been leveled. Yet, there was not a single fatality, not one. Thanks to Billy's calm and experienced leadership, the 3,000 employees and visitors attending Vermeer's Customer Appreciation Day were safe. Despite an all clear issued by a paid weather service, Billy and his team kept everyone sheltered and in doing so saved their lives. Billy, please stand so that we can recognize your service, leadership, and bravery. Last year, we saw the same thing play out again and again. On that same day, separate tornadoes ripped through Bondurant, Marshalltown, destroying homes and businesses in their paths. In the days and weeks that followed, hundreds of volunteers showed up to clear debris and rebuild. Last year, we saw the same thing play out again and again all across Iowa. And in times of need, Iowans came together. Neighbor helping neighbor, and often stranger helping stranger. Whether it was cleaning up after a tornado or a flood, looking for a missing loved one, or bringing in a harvest after a tragedy, Iowans showed up. It's who we are, and it's why I'm so proud to be your governor. Join me in recognizing the Iowans who every day show acts of kindness and who truly make this the greatest state in the nation. For those of us who have the honor to represent these Iowans, it's our job to live up to the example they set. And there's no better time than the condition of the state and the days that follow to set aside our differences and forge a common vision. Iowans expect no less. Working across the aisle isn't an impossible task. We've done it. And by continuing to put Iowans first, we honor four public servants whose belief in diplomacy, principles, and bipartisanship made an incredible difference in millions of lives. In 2018, America lost a great leader with the passing of President George H.W. Bush, a man whose legacy is one of service, statesmanship, values, and whose commemoration served as a reminder for all Americans of the nobility of public service. Iowa also mourned the passing of Governor Robert D. Ray, whose civility, courage, and common sense style of leadership set the highest standard for those who followed. We grieved the passing of Congressman Boswell, a proud veteran and public servant who willingly reached across the aisle on so many issues to make Iowa a better place. And 3 weeks ago, we lost the legendary U.S. Senator John Culver, whose energy, passion for politics, and timeless wit highlighted the best of Iowa. If we've learned anything from the passing of these devoted public servants, it's this. Working together with deep resolve, we can achieve more than we ever dreamed possible. Last year was another year of significant accomplishments. Together, we passed the largest income tax ever as part of a groundbreaking tax reform package, a record investment in K-12 schools, achieved collaborative water quality bill, my first bill signed as governor. We protected the sanctity of life, provided affordable health care options to thousands of Iowans, and by unanimous vote, enacted comprehensive mental health care reform and the Future Ready Iowa Act. Indeed, it was an historic year. As we begin the 88th General Assembly, I am proud to declare that the condition of our state is strong. Our budget is balanced. Our cash reserves are full. Wages are going up. Unemployment is at an all-time low. Because of the people and the power of their ingenuity, Iowa is soaring. I know, however, that not everyone feels that success. I know that in family rooms, workplaces, and even in this chamber, there are Iowans who are struggling, sometimes in silence. Today, I'm asking this legislature to work with me again, to fight for those individuals, to make sure that Iowa's success is every Iowan's success. A year ago, I stood at this podium and I told you that my vision for the future is an Iowa overflowing with opportunity. Opportunity for working families, young people, and our communities, both urban and rural. A place where it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, young or old, male or female, where your last name or zip code aren't nearly as important as your ability to dream and your willingness to reach for it. A place where if life got in the way of those dreams, you can make a new start. And if you've made a mistake, you can find a second chance. My vision for the future of Iowa hasn't changed. But the future I see, it's not around the corner or after the next election. The future is now. The time is now to deliver on the promises that we've made to Iowans looking for a way up. It starts by taking the next step to prepare Iowans for dynamic careers and lifelong learning. And really, that's what Future Ready Iowa is all about. At its core, it recognizes that there is dignity and meaningful work, that Iowans yearn for the opportunity to better themselves. And guess what? Those opportunities are right here in Iowa. It directs resources where we need them most. It identifies high-demand jobs like computer programmers and electricians. It educates Iowans about those opportunities and provides support for individuals seeking rewarding careers. We've already started putting the policy into action. Last fall, Future Ready Iowa summits were hosted in 18 communities across our state. We brought together employers, educators, and local leaders to discuss how communities could use Future Ready Iowa as a springboard to propel Iowans into new careers. In fact, at one of the summits, the North Scott superintendent decided to launch an apprenticeship program for advanced manufacturing, attracting the interest of employers like John Deere and Eagle Engineering, and students like Maya Harrington. To encourage education and training beyond high school, Fairway has started a program to help employees pay down their student debt. And Ruan Transportation started a technology apprenticeship program for giving young Iowans yet another path. We will see this play out again and again and again over the next few years. Future Ready Iowa is a powerful tool to grow family incomes, meet employer needs, and strengthen our communities. The time is now to invest in Iowans and their future, and today I'm calling on the legislature to take the next step to appropriate $20 million to fund the plan that we put in place last session. Of course, the road to success and to find a rewarding career doesn't start after high school. A strong K-12 education system is the foundation of any state, and Iowa has a solid foundation to build upon. Our schools are filled with innovative teachers that are making things happen. We have the most extensive teacher leadership and compensation system in the country, a nationally recognized STEM program, and we're getting closer to our goal of making sure that all students are reading proficiently by the end of third grade. And that's really just a sample of the critical work that's underway in our state. But there's more that we have to do. Kids today are growing up immersed in a world of digital technology. The workforce is continually impacted by innovation and globalization. We need an education system that adapts to those changes. Because of our investment in STEM, apprenticeships, work-based learning, and computer science, it's happening now across our state. In August, we launched a new program called Computer Science is Elementary. And through STEM grants, this public-private partnership will transform 6 high-poverty elementary schools into models of computer science instruction by weaving computer coding into their class lessons. We're also seeing other elementary schools expanding or creating computer science programs. Clear Lake is expanding coding and other fundamentals for fourth and fifth graders. Kingsley Pearson is training teachers to teach computer science. And Indianola is teaching coding to kindergartners, first and second graders. Iowa students are getting amazing real-world learning experiences, like Central Campus in Des Moines, where this week, high school students will start a semester-long program called NeuroSmart. Through partnerships with Kemen, Des Moines University, and the STEM Council, these students will get hands-on experience in the fields of neuroscience and business. In the gallery, we have students from the Central Campus with us today. Please stand so we can recognize you, and we look forward to seeing what the future holds for you. The budget I'm submitting today proposes over $93 million in additional funding for pre-K-12 education, which includes a 2.3% increase in per-pupil funding. I'm also requesting $11.2 million to reduce higher transportation costs per pupil and $1 million in new money for STEM funding. In total, that would bring our pre-K through 12 investment to almost $3.4 billion this year, an investment that we can be proud of. But, you know, Iowans also know that the quality of education can't be reduced to a dollar figure or a percent increase. It's about one thing and one thing only, how we prepare our children to succeed. Over the last 8 years, I have been so blessed to travel the nation and the world on behalf of Iowa. These trips have provided ideas on what we can do better, but also they've given me perspective on what makes Iowa so unique. From river to river and border to border, Iowa is speckled with vibrant communities, each with its own character and story to tell. Every 10, 15, or 20 miles, there's another town, another school brimming with pride, and another main street filled with excitement and hope. These unique communities motivate thousands to ride their bikes from the Missouri to the Mississippi each year. They're what gives Iowa its character. Unfortunately, in some places, that character is fading, and we cannot let that happen. Our communities and main streets tell a story to the outside world. So my question to each of you is this: How do we want our story to read? That we've given up, or that we're full of hope for the future? That we're tired or full of energy? That we've lost our vision, or we're innovative and creative? That we're fading or growing? As I travel our 99 counties, I've seen the story that many Iowans are writing, and I've seen the potential to do more. And that's what led me to create the Governor's Empower Rural Iowa Initiative, a partnership between my office and the Iowa Rural Development Council. Led by Lieutenant Governor Gregg and Sandy Eric, the initiative focused on connecting, investing, and growing rural communities. I want to thank the Lieutenant Governor and Sandy for their leadership, the Iowa Rural Development Council for their partnership, and the members of the Empower Rural Iowa Initiative for their ideas in developing the initial recommendations. And I think the executive committee is with us today, so if you'll stand so we can recognize you, I would appreciate it. It's no secret we need to keep our communities connected if we hope to keep and attract young people. Over a century ago, our town's proximity to the railroad was key. Over the last 100 years, our focus has been on highways and interstates. And by the way, it's that focus that finally gave us a completed four-lane U.S. Highway 20. Now, it's virtual connectivity that has become a necessity. Businesses, schools, hospitals, and even our combines rely on high-speed internet. U.S. News and World Report says, and I quote, "The Hawkeye State leads the nation in efforts to bring ultra-fast access to every city block and every rural acre. But I know, and we know, there's more to do. To ensure that every part of Iowa has the same opportunity, I'm requesting $20 million split over 2 years for broadband infrastructure. This funding will accelerate expansion and leverage an additional $120 million in private investment for high-speed internet." Rural communities also can't thrive without access to housing. Business in rural Iowa, businesses are growing and hiring, but the employees that they need won't make the move if there's no place for them to call home. I'm therefore requesting that we double the amount of the workforce housing tax credits that are set aside for rural communities, bringing the total to $10 million. These tax credits should also be competitive, meaning that they will go to projects that are well planned and not just first in line. When it comes to building strong communities, the talent is there, the drive is there, and often the programs are, but the connectivity isn't. And that's why today I'm announcing the creation of a Center for Rural Revitalization within the Iowa Economic Development Authority. This center will focus on making rural Iowa an even greater priority and give our main streets a roadmap for success. In places like Jefferson, Iowans are already showing that with ingenuity and drive, our small towns can be as vibrant as they've ever been. Since 2012, over 100 Greene County residents volunteered over 29,000 hours to raise funds, write grants, and work on committees. They've transformed downtown Jefferson, attracting 14 businesses and rehabbing dozens of buildings. And just recently, voters overwhelmingly approved a bond referendum that will build a new high school, that will house a career academy, that will feed to a new downtown business called The Forge. The Forge, owned by Pillar Technologies, will employ 30 technology consultants, many of them just out of high school. Pillar has successfully brought that same concept to the Silicon Valley, Columbus, Ohio, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Des Moines. And now it's coming to downtown Jefferson. Why? Why? Because even people in our nation's largest cities can see what rural Iowa has to offer. People like Kevin Scott, the chief technology officer of Microsoft, and a group of technology investors who visited Jefferson last month. Now, not every Iowa town will be home to a technology consulting firm, but we should help ignite every community with the passion of the people in Greene County, some of whom are with us today. Thank you for being that spark, showing us what is possible. And so please stand so we can recognize the great work that you're doing. Oh. Since taking the oath of office, one of my priorities has been to create an integrated and coordinated healthcare system. We made great strides on that effort last year. We passed legislation that gave Iowans affordable healthcare options. We worked diligently and still are to ensure that our Medicaid program is sustainable and focused on patient outcomes. We unanimously passed mental health reform, which built on the changes we began in 2013. And we're seeing results. In a recent report, Mental Health America declared that Iowa's overall mental health system is the 7th best in the nation, and 3rd when it comes to the adult system. And that's before the legislation from last year has been fully implemented. This year, the mental health regions are continuing to develop new services. And to help sustain them, I've set aside an additional $11 million in my 2-year Medicaid budget. I'm also calling on the legislature to extend the time the regions have to spend down their capital balances and to increase the percent of their operating budgets that may be carried over from 1 year to the next. But there is more to do. I'm asking everyone in this chamber to work with me to ensure that we have sustainable funding that keeps our mental health system strong. Another essential piece of a strong mental health system is having adequate behavioral health providers. To build on the existing and successful psychiatric residency program, my budget also proposes to fund 4 additional psychiatric residencies at the University of Iowa for doctors who will practice in rural Iowa. I've also asked for new funding to train nurse practitioners and physician assistants on mental health also through the University of Iowa. Our efforts aren't over yet, but by working together, we will have the best adult mental health system in the country. When it comes to our children and their changing mental health needs, we're not as far along. That's not for a lack of talking and working on it. We've been doing that for more than 20 years. It's time to move past the talking phase. There's no worse pain than that of a child who is suffering in silence, and there is no greater agony than that of a parent who watches helplessly, not knowing where or whom they can turn to. Diagnosing and healing illness is never guaranteed, but when it comes to physical pain, parents know the path to get there. The doctor will see you now is usually just a few minutes or hours away. When it comes to mental health, however, part of the fear and the pain is not knowing where to begin, in being told that no one provides the right services, or that your child is on a wait list and can't be seen for 2 to 3 months. We must create a children's mental health system where the path to healing is clearly marked, a system that lets parents know where to start and that their child can begin immediately. That's why I created a children's mental health board last year. I ask a group of educators, mental health professionals, parents, legislators, and children's advocates to devise a plan and create a structure for a children's mental health system. The board has completed its initial task, and based on its recommendation, I will be introducing a bill that finally creates a children's mental health system. I'm also calling on the legislature to appropriate additional money for home and community-based children's mental health services so that we can eliminate the waiting list that currently exists. And I'm also requesting $3 million in new money to help train our educators to better recognize early signs of mental illness. Creating a comprehensive children's mental health system will take time, but we can and we must take action. The days of merely talking are over. Three years ago, we began to offer apprenticeship programs to our state prisons. The concept isn't hard to understand. Most of our inmates aren't inmates for life. They will reenter society, and when they do, we want them to be successful. Those who can't find a job often find their way back to crime and then back to prison. So from a public safety perspective, training our inmates is the right thing to do. But there's really more to it than that. As I said earlier, there is dignity in work, and there is also beauty in grace. Talk with someone who, by their own actions, hit rock bottom, but decided to turn their life around. Watch their face light up when they tell you about the person who offered them a helping hand, a family member, a friend, or a stranger. There are few things as powerful as the joy of someone who got a second chance and found their purpose. If you talk to Michael Willoughby or Steve Shrury, you'll see it. Both of them completed an apprenticeship program in prison. Michael prepared to be a computer programmer. Steve prepared for a career in welding. Both men committed serious crimes. Today, both men are star employees at jobs that they landed before leaving prison. They were offered a second chance, they took it, and they succeeded. Frontier Co-op in Norway and Winger in Ottumwa are the other half of this story. Those are the employers who saw something in Michael and Steve. They looked beyond the rap sheet and found high-quality employees for hard-to-fill jobs. Too often, employers overlook these skilled workers because of the fear of lawsuits. So let's take that off the table. Our correctional system and parole board are the judge of whether an inmate is ready to be released. Let's not punish employers for offering an offender a second chance. I'm calling on the legislature to send me a bill that protects employers like Frontier and Winger who hire Iowans with criminal records. Michael and Steve are with us today, and so are Megan from Frontier and Jim Keck from Winger. Please stand so we can thank you for showing us all the value of second chances. We have a skilled worker shortage and a prison full of inmates. So let's get them the skills that they need and place them with the Frontiers and Wingers of the state. To that end, I'm announcing today that we're establishing a new home building program at the Newton Correctional Facility. In partnership with the nonprofit Homes for Iowa, this program will provide housing that is needed throughout Iowa, and it will provide training for jobs that are in high demand. A win-win.
Boys laughing.
There are other programs across the state working to ensure criminal offenders are finding a new purpose, like a pilot program with the Iowa Department of Corrections offered by Iowa Central Community College that offers Pell Grants to prison inmates. This program is one of the most successful in the country, with more than 420 inmates participating, earning an average GPA of 3.5. I also recently met with a group of Iowans led by Tim Kruger, who are working to bring a nonprofit organization called the Other Side Academy to Des Moines. It's a 2-year residential rehabilitation program that is an alternative to prison or jail, and it operates without government funding.
We can do both.
It sustains the program through the businesses run by its participants, and those are just two examples. Together, I believe there's even more we can do, and we can start with felon voting. Our Our Constitution takes away the voting rights of anyone convicted of a felony forever. Only two other state constitutions have a similar provision. And last November, the people of Florida voted to remove their ban. Through the power of clemency, the governor can restore those rights. And I've done that 88 times since taking office. But I don't believe that voting rights should be forever stripped, and I don't believe restoration should be in the hands of a single person. After the election, and Iowa stopped me, and Iowan stopped me at my grandson's basketball game, I had restored his rights, and he wanted to tell me in person how much that meant to him. How when he stepped into the voting booth, he felt a dignity that had been missing even after leaving prison. I don't think this man and others like him who have completed their sentences should have to wait for my say or any future governor's say before they get that dignity back. Our founders gave us a process to amend the Constitution should the passage of time change our view. So let's begin that process now. I believe Iowans recognize the power of redemption. So let's put this issue in their hands. That's not the only constitutional amendment we should consider. As it should, our Constitution deals extensively with the rights of the accused and convicted, but it never mentions victims. In all the focus on second chances and forgiveness, we should never forget about the victims. I know each of you in this room believe that, so let's show it. This year, let's start the process of enshrining victims' rights into the Iowa Constitution like 36 other states have done. Let's send victims a loud and clear message. We will protect you. Over the next few months, I look forward to working with all of you to enact these priorities and yours, whether it's looking for ways to further reform our tax code and help Iowans keep more of their hard-earned money, or passing legislation that strengthens our healthcare system, or working together on criminal justice reform. I am so excited for what the future holds. There is so much capacity and opportunity that exists within this state. We have laid the foundation for a bright future. Let's build on it. The time is now to finish what we started. The time is now to cement Iowa's status as the best state in the nation. And the time is now to deliver on the promises we've made to Iowans looking for a way up. Thank you. God bless you. God bless this great state of Iowa. Thank you.
We've been listening to Governor Kim Reynolds giving her second condition of the state address. This is her first address after being elected to the office for a full four-year term. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Public Radio. Thanks again to Iowa Public Television for making this broadcast possible. And now we're going to talk about what we heard in the speech. And joining me is Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, to help us think back on the speech. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Governor Reynolds has said that this speech really represents a fresh start for her, an opportunity for her to lay out her agenda since she is no longer filling out the rest of Governor Terry Branstad's term. This is her term as the governor. Did you hear a fresh start today?
Well, she certainly seemed very comfortable in delivering the speech, and you could kind of sense that she felt free to express her own views, and I think that was pretty evident in the way the speech finished up in terms of talking about restoring voting rights for felons. This is something that is completely reversing something that her predecessor, Governor Branstad, put into place when he came into office in 2011, when he changed the process that was had been in effect under Governor Vilsack to require felons to directly contact the governor and ask for those voting rights to be restored. It was only Iowa and Florida at the time that had that process changed, and she's now saying that that process needs to change back to the way it was, which is completely reversing what Governor Branstad had, one of his initial acts when he came back into office in 2011.
Doing this through a constitutional amendment, there are other options for pursuing this, right?
Yeah, she could do it through executive order, and I think, you know, when we're talking about a constitutional amendment, we have to remember how that process works, that this will take a little bit of time. When you're talking about amending the Iowa Constitution, this is a proposal needs to be passed by two consecutive general assemblies. That means that there needs to be an intervening election in between there. So if it passes this year, it would also need to pass after the 2020 election, meaning in the spring of 2021, and then it could go to the voters. So this is still a very drawn-out process if we go through the constitutional amendment process.
And she was also recommending a second constitutional amendment that would enshrine victims' rights into the Constitution as well. I mean, do you think that's in an effort to create some balance before there's criticism?
Well, I think both probably have bipartisan support. I think that the really interesting one both are very interesting, but the one on felon rights is really interesting, not only for the political signal it sends in terms of reversing course from Governor Branstad, but also, you know, this relates to a lot of research and social science research talking about the signal that, you know, having someone's voting rights taken away sends to that individual. It gives them a sense about their worth. It gives them a sense about how government views them. And what we know from research is that when you change that, if people do feel like they're valued, they are more likely to participate. They are more likely to feel better about how government feels about them, and they're more likely to engage in the political process. So I think both are quite interesting.
Well, and there was, for my ears, there was a lot of bipartisan applause during this part of the speech, during the entire part of the speech, where she was also talking about job opportunities, training, and internships for people in the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. And so, I would expect that this would be an issue where you would see some movement from both parties, because it will give both Democrats and Republicans something to say that they've accomplished. And given how polarized the political environment is right now, this may be something that both sides really want to work on to show that they can still get something done despite all kind of the hyper-partisan atmosphere that we live in.
Well, and clearly this was the culmination of the speech. This is part of her charting her course. But I want to talk about some of the other things she talked about in the speech as well. She spent a long time talking about mental health care in Iowa. And, of course, that's something we've been talking a lot about. But what kinds of differences did you hear in this speech as opposed to some of the things we've been hearing in recent years?
Well, I think, you know, certainly she wants to continue what's been done in terms of improving mental health reform and improving access. She's talked about changing the way the budgets are operated within the mental health system in terms of allowing for some carryover within budgets. She mentioned the better access in rural Iowa, talking about funding for four additional psychiatric residencies through the University of Iowa.
Right, and of course we have a terrible shortage of psychiatrists in the state. So
right, so providing access in rural Iowa there. New funding for training nurse practitioners. But then also she obviously spent a lot of time talking about child health care reform, that isn't at the level that she wants it, and that there needs to be more done for child health care reform, including funding for educators or funding for teachers as far as recognizing and training to deal with students who have mental health issues.
And cutting down on those wait times, giving patients an opportunity to receive behavioral treatments in addition to the sort of medical or medicinal treatments.
Right. And again, I think this is an issue where there's bipartisan support. I think where there's been criticism in the past is that the funding hasn't always matched up with the rhetoric. But I think that's what's going to be interesting to watch this session, is to see if we really do see more funding and really an improved access and improved care across the board.
Right. And we did hear her talk about funding, but not a whole lot of details.
Right. Right. That's something we're still waiting on.
All right. And as you mentioned, a long bipartisan applause during that part of the speech as well. So, again, very well received in the chamber. Let's talk about school funding. She talked about including a 2.3% increase in per pupil funding in the state of Iowa, $93 million in additional funding for preschool through high school education. What does that mean?
Well, again, from a political standpoint, this is a little bit of a break from the Branstad administration. I mean, if you remember during the first few years of kind of 2011, 12, 13, 14, there was a lot of criticism over the per pupil spending increase, that it started to get around the 0 to 1.5% range. There was a couple years, I think, right around 1.1%. Some of that per pupil additional spending was vetoed by Governor Branstad. So again, you know, I see this as more evidence of kind of charting her own course, where she sees priorities for the state. And you mentioned, you know, $11.2 million per pupil spending for transportation. So clearly trying to address some of the needs that are out there for pre-K through 12 education.
Well, and 2.3% increase in per pupil funding, that's about the rate of inflation. So although it's higher than the increases we've seen in recent years, it's not necessarily a significant increase, is it?
Well, you know, I don't know necessarily as far as with the rate of inflation how that's going to work out, but I think it's different than what we've seen in the past. I mean, if you think back kind of on the history of per pupil spending, it's generally around that 2 to 4% range. You know, it'll vary a little bit. It's just we had the last several years it seemed to have dipped below 2%. So the fact that it's starting off at 2.3%, I think, is interesting. What we'll have to watch for, obviously, is how the House and Senate Republican leadership reacts and adjust that number.
Right. I was just going to ask how likely the GOP lawmakers are to follow that lead.
Well, and that goes back to the old saying about these type of speeches, right? It's the governor that proposes, but then the legislature disposes. And so it'll be interesting to see how does her party react to this.
There was a lot in this speech for rural communities in Iowa. What was your response to that?
Well, this is something we've heard about throughout her administration, talking about improving, as she mentioned, kind of the character or the story around rural Iowa. And I think that is one of the themes throughout the speech, whether you're talking about health care reform or funding for schools, is that improving opportunities for Iowans living in rural Iowa. And we've seen, you know, there's been a number of reports talking about the declines in rural Iowa, whether it's population or just the type and quality of services being offered there. And so I think she's trying to reach out. And obviously her background is from rural Iowa as well. And I think it was interesting she mentioned again, you know, talking about access to rural broadband or high-speed internet access for rural Iowa. This is something that I think goes back to 2014, 2015, when Governor Branstad was talking about the Connect Every Iowan or Connect Every Acre.
Right. It feels like that's something I've heard in this condition of the state address every year.
Yes. Yeah. And they continue to talk about that. So I think,
right.
You know,
but she was also talking about housing in rural communities. And that was new to me this year.
Yeah. That is interesting because, I mean, that's trying to address clearly that these rural areas in Iowa are dealing with population issues and declining populations, and trying to get populations to go back to rural Iowa by saying that if you have businesses there, you need to have the housing there for the employees of those businesses. And so that's a proposal that's seeming to go in against the kind of the demographic trends that we've been hearing about the last 5-10 years.
Well, and I thought she, of course, singled out Jefferson and some of the things that have been going on in Jefferson, Iowa, in Greene County. And I felt like that went beyond some of what we have heard rhetoric-wise about, you know, strong main streets.
Yeah, a little bit. And, again, I think it's just interesting to see her talking about something that, like I said, is kind of going against the demographic trends of the state, but it's also, you know, it may be part of her background, right? This is where she maybe feels the most comfortable, is talking to rural Iowans, because she feels like she can relate to them maybe easier than she can to an urban electorate.
Iowa has been in national news the last couple of days with the comments made by Representative Steve King. The governor has distanced herself a little bit from the man who, you know, was her campaign chair. And I was curious, in the beginning of the speech, she said, a place where it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, young or old, male or female. I was a little surprised that she didn't take that opportunity to include some kind of statement about race, given how controversial that is right now.
Yeah, I would think that a statement is probably forthcoming on that from her administration. It may have been that she wanted to focus specifically on the condition of the state, specifically on setting her agenda and the things she wants to get done, so that the attention is on that agenda, and then maybe have a separate statement dealing with the controversy around Congressman King.
So what's your overall takeaway from the speech today? Again, it seemed well received within the chambers.
It was well received. I think it was, you know, a pretty straightforward speech. You didn't see her listing out, you know, 10, 15 different things she wants to do. There were very clear themes throughout the speech, as we've talked about, in terms of rural Iowa, you know, talking about reforms in the criminal justice systems in terms of voting, felon rights, restoring felons' voting rights, just, you know, restoring how felons are sort of reacclimated to society, and then talking about education funding. So I think you can kind of see, you know, maybe two, three different themes throughout. But again, as you said, most of them have bipartisan support. And so I think what that does is that sets her up well for at least accomplishing some of her agenda. So when the 2019 session is over, or when you get into 2020, she's able to say, and you know, if we do this again next year, she can say that, you know, a few of the things she talked about in 2019 were actually passed, and she was able to sign some of those into law.
Do you feel like this speech indicates that she is forging her own path, and we're going to see some differences from the Branstad administration?
I think it's the first step in that direction. It certainly seems like that. I think what's going to be interesting is what happens next, because it is her own party that controls the legislature, and sometimes that can get away from you.
Chris Larimer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Of course, we were listening this hour to Governor Kim Reynolds. She gave her second condition of the state address, her first after being elected to the office for a full 4-year term. Followed that up with some analysis of what we heard today. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.